January 23rd, 2008 is Salat from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
From Pedro Show. Started off with John Coltrane live version of Cosmos live in Seattle, and then we heard Boston and Bombay by the Book of Knots. Both tunes fitting because I'm here in San Francisco at Tiny Telephone Studio recording with the Book of Knots folks, and with me right now is Tony Maloney.
Hey everybody.
And the theme of this one, well, we'll get into the concept behind the Book of Knots period a little bit, but for this third one here, it's space, so that's why it's fitting, maybe, for having John Coltrane do Cosmos.
Yeah.
So, Tony, the Book of Knots, it's 5 years going now, and this is the third record.
It's hard to believe it's been 5 years, Mike. It's like, wow. I remember earlier today you asked me about it. I was going to say 3.5 going on 4, and then Matthias said 5. 2003 was when we first started. I remember talking to Joel and the Matthias about it back up at Joel's grandmother's house up on the Cape.
Cape Cod.
In Cape Cod. That's like where Joel and Matthias are both from.
But they must have came out here at some time.
Yeah. Well, Matthias came out here a few years ago after he met Carla. And Who's the fourth member, yeah. They're in the Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, they're headquartered out here in Oakland, I think, is where most of them are from.
They're quite a troop.
Boy, powerful.
I played with them in Missouri. They were traveling around in a school bus, and a lot of cats in that unit.
Yeah.
And the gig is kind of... very musical, but it's also kind of theatrical.
Oh, yeah.
Great band, great ensemble, whatever. So, you were talking about it.
Yeah, we were talking about it, and it's hard to imagine that was 5 years ago, but it definitely was. And that first record, we were thinking about, like, nautical themes. You know, boats and the ocean and sailors and
hence Boston to Bombay.
Yeah, Boston to Bombay. You know, it was and you know, the Cape, you know, there's so, you know, it's the most unique piece of land, you know. The ecosystem in Cape Cod is like none other anywhere else in the world. It's basically like what the glacier left behind.
Wow.
So it's just like a necklace of land going out into the sea. And so those guys grew up there, both of them. And Matthias's parents are both teachers, school teachers, so they got like thousands of books in the house. And I remember Matthias bringing the Book of Knots the studio.
How to Tie 'Em.
Yeah, How to Tie 'Em. It's a huge book, and it's beautifully illustrated. And so that's kind of where the name came from.
You know the Blue Jacket Manual?
I don't know the Blue Jacket.
It's a book they give you when you join the Navy as
Matthias right here.
Yeah.
So what is it?
My pop gave me his. It's when you join the Navy, they give you this blue. This is the rules. This is what you got to learn from a sailor. And so the first thing I looked for was how you tie the knots. But it was way in the back. First they teach you how to march and all this crap.
Of course.
But I got to the knots and I really dug that. So, so you brainstorm this idea. We're going to make a unit around the sea.
Well, it was like, at first, it wasn't so premeditated, but then it became, you know, it just started to unfold. Like a lot of the things do with this group, it's like people start to, you know, as we like record things, they seem to take more and more shape.
Yeah.
We had that goose here.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
I had the udon.
Mine's with the beef.
Oh my God, here's my work.
7 or 77?
Here's a 20.
That's a love song, right? 7 and 7 is?
7 and 7 is. Do 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 do.
Tricky pop song.
Yeah.
Boop bap bap boop bap bap. No backbeat.
Yeah, no backbeat.
But anyway, you four are the core, but then you bring in...
Well, like what we did is we asked Carla to come in and play on some songs. And
You three were the core.
Well, that was the beginning.
Yeah.
And Carla was just so... Well, she's like so powerful. It was just really obvious. Like, wow, well, if she'll be in the band, let's have her too. But then so many people came...
Like John, right?
Came and played on that record. the whole idea of the Book of Knots now is... It's much more like a kind of open structure, like with, you know, the four of us or whatever. But I don't know. Like, I think, you know, so many projects or bands have a lot of rules and regulations, even though, you know, musicians fancy themselves to be really free and everything. You know, there's tons and tons of issues boundaries and stuff. So I think, like, with this project, you know, the idea was, like, let's try to leave things as open as we can. Also, because everybody works in the studio, whether they're recording all the time or whether they're engineering, and you know, there's also another, that's another case where you've got lots and lots of boundaries,
right?
Lots and lots of issues and lots of thing parameters that you have to work in. I think one of the things that we like to do here is, like, I remember on that first record, Joel was priding himself on not tuning his guitar. You know, I'm not going to tune. Just going to let it go. And it just kind of a healthy, like, reaction to having to, you know, toe the line. Did you tune in between every take? And so, you know, it's a, this project's been an opportunity for people to really, you know, not worry so much about doing what's right and getting it to sound the way it's supposed to sound.
Where did you meet them guys? Did you actually go out to Cape Cod?
Well, where I met Joel on the street. Like, he was drinking coffee and we started
Manhattan,
talking.
Brooklyn?
Brooklyn, right around the corner from the studio. This was back when Joel was looking for a job. He had just moved to Brooklyn. Okay. And he told me about, you know, where he'd been engineering, and I could tell he was a super qualified dude. So I took him down the street to the Neve room, and he started working there right away. And he worked there for a while, but he always kept coming by. You're the udon, I think I'm the soba. You know, I used to keep coming by and saying, hey man, you know, if there's anything I can do around here, let me know. And you know, I wasn't super busy, I was just starting out, and you know, I didn't really need somebody else. But then, like, you know, more and more work came, and then I was like, yeah, well, come on, do this, do that. And little by little, he just was there more and more, and then one day he was just there every day.
You're talking about your past Studio G.
Studio G, and then, like, the band kind of came out of that.
Ah, okay.
So the studio came
first. And you knew Matthias from growing up.
He did, yeah. They both grew up on the Cape. And then, so I met Matthias through Joel.
Yeah.
And Matthias met Carla. He was on the road with Skeleton Key, and their van broke down. And the Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum bus came through the desert, and there's these dudes, like, you know, on the road, flagging a ride.
Wow.
So that's how Matthias met Carla.
Ain't that a trip?
Yeah.
How long did it take you to do that first album?
You know, we did, you know, we probably did 3 or 4 sessions. 3 or 4 days, like, where we did basic tracks. Just like that track that we just did in there where everybody was playing acoustic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we did...
Never played piano before.
Yeah, we did, like, 45 minutes, almost an hour of recording like that. And then we also did probably another hour of electric stuff.
It's only 3 or 4 days. All them songs came out of that.
Well, and then editing those, like, you know, into songs. It was, like, for sure a year.
And bringing cats in,
bringing people in, sending people stuff. Just like we sent you that track for the second record.
Oh yeah, but I'll get that later. We're still in first album.
Right. But the same thing. Yeah. Sending people stuff, seeing if they, you know, felt something, you know, for the track, and then getting what they recorded back and putting that into the track.
Sure. Yeah, because John Makons.
Yeah, Johnny Langford.
And what did you just, because you knew him from playing with him, right?
I sent him the music on, for 3 of those. Actually 2, right?
Okay.
The Hook and Captain's Cup and Back on Dry Land. And, you know, he told me, he said he wrote those things on the way to the studio in plane, you know. That guy, man, he's amazing. He just went out there and, you know, I remember it was the morning and, you know, we had a couple of hours and then, you know, John had a show in town that night.
Bing, bang, boom.
Yeah, man.
Wow.
That guy drops it.
Yeah. I really like what he did in both of the songs, but I love that poem, you know, The Captain's Cup, and he's got that Welsh accent. It's so good. Yeah, and then Megan Riley's on it, and I play with her, and she had been rehearsing with us. She came walking through the room, and Joel said, "Hey, Megan, do you want to sing something on this on Frank's funeral?" She said, "Sure." And she just went out there and straight up just improvised.
Wow.
A couple takes, that's it.
Did she explain the concept, or she just went with
it? You know, on that song, she was kind of left to her own devices.
Right.
On the other song, on Hook, I remember I wrote a few lines for her and gave her the idea of, I mean, just, you know, I'd been reading this book about whaling, you know, and the guys going out on the whale boats. And Joel's grandma's house is at the end of Old Whale Road.
Ah.
Or it's Whale Road. I can't remember exactly the name of it. But so I just jotted down a couple things on a piece of paper, and Megan just put it all together and improvised it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Carla sings Tugboat.
Yep.
What's the story about that?
She basically takes on the character of the tugboat, you know? You know? And
that was her idea?
Yeah, yeah. I love some of those lines.
Well, we're going to hear it right now, okay?
Awesome.
Thank you. off. It's depressing me.
From Pedro Show. We just heard The Musk Deer by The Musk Deer. And before that, the Night Porter with Monkeys. And Night Porter is a band that Carl Bozlich had. And everybody put out good vibes to Carla healing up once because some very troubled person punched her up in very severely and Paris on the street in the weirdest kind of situation, but she's getting better. And then we started off that chunk there with Tugboat by the Book of Knots, and that had this Carla
different
Kilstead. One right Kilstead, who's right now doing some overdubs on this third Book of Knot record, the space concept one.
We got a song for you, man.
Yeah.
Just be along.
All right.
Absolutely something, you
okay.
know.
Okay. Then we
Chuck
should
Yeager.
We should go to the music then.
How yeah. I like impersonating Chuck Yeager.
Chuck
Break the sound barrier.
That's perfect for you, man.
Do we have any literature on Chuck
Yeager?
Yeah,
you should just be an astronaut. For real.
Yeah.
He was the only astronaut that never got to be one.
I know.
You should be a spurned, disgruntled astronaut.
Better as.
Like, wow. Basically, like, you know, seriously, like, angry, kind of spurned, like, patriot. Part of the space race that never got to actually
that got spaced.
It. Yeah, yeah. I was the one that didn't get spaced.
All right, here's some music.
Damn, your eyes have lost the ship. High 12 days in the open launch adrift, we shunned the savage shores. Reduced to astral navigation through sickness, hunger, and hallucination, I recall one wailing captain who ate his sister's son, and his crew drew lots that chose the lad to be the one. Though the captain offered himself, 'twas to no avail, and in the end used his own gun. And soon, too soon after this deed was done, they met land, and the captain wished instead that it was he who lay half-eaten and full of dead, or at least unfed. So fear not, man, we'll have none of that business here, for we are British sailors and gentlemen, and if needs be, we'll die like them. There's naught to drink or eat, there's water everywhere, and all the boards decree. Take courage, man, if all else fails, we'll snag some stupid seabird in the rigging of our makeshift sail and weigh its flesh on these delicate brass scales to most fairly divide it up and drink its thick, warm blood from the captain's cup. Thank you. Now the launch, she clips, and the coast is clear. See no ships. And the sunset looks like a great pair of purple glowing fish lips coming over the horizon to gobble us all down. Oh, for a sorry repast, and belch a rotten stench out on the last. The last winds of the world.
Watt from Pedro Show, Captain's Cup, song that John did with the Book of Knots. Johnny Langford wrote that on the plane coming to the studio, had a gig after, sandwiched it in there.
For real.
And, yeah, what a trip. Well, hell, we're at the end of the first hour of the January 23rd, 2008 Watt from Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two.
Right on.
January 23rd, 2008, the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. And I'm here with Tony, and we're talking about the Book of Knots, since we're here at the Tiny Telephone Studio doing third Book of Knots. In fact, I've been just invited to do a rant on Mr. Chuck Yeager.
That's going to be good, Mike.
I just heard the backing track, and Book of Knots 2 comes out, and it's called Train Eater, and the concept behind that. Well, first, did you ever think that Book of Knots was going to be more than the one record?
Yeah, we always said from the beginning that we were going to do at least three records. And that the first one was going to be about the nautical, the sea, the sailing life. And then we didn't know what the second and the third were going to be about. Anyway, we thought, oh, let's do one about Rust Belt. Because the first one, nautical, you know, the Cape, Joel and Matthias being from the Cape, okay, and Rust Belt, Sea Town,
yeah,
Pedro. So we're like, all right, and the Train Eater, that I got a friend, his name's Tom Songs. Tom took the picture that we made the cover for Train Eater. What it is it's a blast furnace.
Yeah.
It looks like a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Really. And Tom took that picture right before they blew it up. And Tom told us a story. We were already beginning to talk about making the second record. And he told us a story about what they do. Now, that blast furnace that's on the cover of Train Eater, that's a blast furnace, old number 6, out of Youngstown, Ohio. And if you guys get the record, there's a song on the record called Train Eater that Carla sings, and you'll hear what I'm talking about. But anyway, the whole idea with these blast furnaces, they never turn them off, because once they fire them up, they go until they're done. And when they're finally done, what they do is they blow them up or they cut them up into huge chunks, weld them on the old train cars, and then push the whole thing, the train cars and the pieces of the blast furnace, right into another blast furnace and just melt it down. So that's where the idea of Train Eater comes from. And that's why there's a picture of the blast furnace on the cover. Anyway, like, so all of these songs are really about people in the situation of just decaying industry.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like where we're at even still today.
Yeah, it's not so funny.
No, it ain't.
It's a heavy trip.
Yeah.
Okay, so the
topic's a little different from the first album. Was it made different?
Well,
some different folks. I know Watts on there. He wasn't on the first one.
Watts on there. David Thomas sings on a song. John Langford is on again. Megan Riley's on there again. Alan, the guy who does the lights for Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, he did the vocals on the Ballad of John Henry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Carla Bozlich is on it again.
Pedro.
Yeah, and Rick Moody, the guy who wrote the book Ice Storm, they made the movie, he's on there with a story that's really harrowing about a company town.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Hewlett-Smithson.
How did you run into him?
He's actually a friend of a bunch of people that have recorded in Studio G.
Okay.
David Grubbs.
Oh.
And there's a whole crew of people that we know of that we're all like friends. He actually lives in Williamsburg, so okay. Small world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So that was all done at the G.
Yeah, it was all done at the G. I'm trying to think. The Tom Waits track.
Yeah.
Tom actually wanted us to send him a 4-track cassette. And so we sent him the cassette with one of the tracks being just the backing track. And then he and his wife sang on two of the tracks, and he played guitar on one of the tracks.
Sent you back the cassette.
Sent us back the
cassette.
How'd
you get contact with him?
Basically through Carla. Carla was... Carla, you were doing recording with Tom, right, at the time?
Yeah, I've done a few things with him. I can't remember how that actually linked up with the timing-wise, but yeah, I was doing a couple tracks for his Bastards and Brawlers CD.
Yeah.
I had given him a copy of the first record, and his son had told, I mean, they really loved it, but his son really, really loved it. So they were all excited to be involved in the second.
Did you flow him a concept, or did you just give him the concept of the record?
I don't know. Like, what did you tell him, Carla?
Concept of the record.
Yeah.
That's it.
Because that's kind of all I got.
You know?
I was just trying to parallel my town. And, you know, I've played Cleveland a bunch of times. My first maybe 10 times of playing the town was on the flats. I didn't play no Cleveland Heights not until way later.
It just works so great, like the way that all, where you say Cuyahoga over the flats and Wu Fei's playing, you know, like that Chinese. What's the name of that instrument that Faith plays?
She's an incredible musician.
Guzheng.
Yeah. Is she Brooklyn too?
No. I don't know where. I mean, when we met her, was she
Colorado?
That's right.
Yeah.
She's been really busy.
Yeah, and I played some of her stuff on the show. Incredible, trippy music. For me, I don't really know that stuff, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Damn, wild. But so everybody just gets the record concept. Nobody gets the script. The two script. So like
as it should be.
Yeah, as it should be. Now we're gonna It was kind of made like the first one, just kind of expanded maybe a little more?
Yeah, I mean the fact that we, you know, we did the backing tracks kind of the same, like it's a combination of people having like an idea or even like a sequence, you know, like in a sequencer or like a definite melody. Certain people bring ideas in and then the rest of the people collaborate and... I don't know. It's like a lot of the way that the music comes together is just by listening to it, and you know, people deciding that, well, let's try doing this, let's try doing that, and a bunch of stuff kind of gets thrown at it, and then when Joel's mixing it, it becomes rather obvious, like what needs to get turned up, turned down, or
what
muted.
Gets tossed.
Yeah, yeah, of course. So.
Like a farmer would tell you, if you want a good crop, use a lot of manure. And we're going to play 4 songs here in a row from the second.
Right, this first one, Red Apple Boy, David Thomas is singing on that.
Right.
And
what's the trip behind that?
Well, you know, we came up with the tune and I'm listening to it and I just thought, oh, David could definitely do something. We sent him the music. You know, he wrote that totally on his own, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he actually recorded it at his home studio. And I really like the effect he put on his voice.
Yeah.
It's really
David Thomas,
cool.
Singer Parobu.
Yeah, my old bandmate.
Right. Who's still putting out Parobu.
Oh, yeah. Like, David's got a... He's kind of reinstated... His label from back in the day was called Hearthen Records.
Right, right.
And I think he's calling it Hearpen now. And I know, because I just read about it in the email, that David's also, making downloads available to people. People go to Ubu Projects,
right,
they can
right.
read all about it. But I know that he's going to put the Home and Garden record out on
oh,
that.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so, you know, he's just trying to get stuff in, like people that are related, you know, have done projects with Parobu or with people from Parobu. He's trying to make it available. But I really like what David does on that. And then next we're going to have what, View from the Tower. That's
right.
the Carla Bozlich
right.
tune, man. When she came in to do that tune, she was like,
oh, really? now she doesn't do it at home. She comes into the G.
She comes into the G, and she had it all like up in her laptop. And so she starts writing it out. And so we thought, well, yeah, well, go ahead. She's, I need to write this out. So we say, yeah, go ahead, write it out. So 20 minutes later, like someone goes in there and she's still writing. Like she's got like, you know, like pages. And we're like, well.
On the road.
Yeah. We're like, Carly, you know, it's like, you know, the tune's only 5 minutes long. But she had like so much written out. And so she finally like, you know, I could tell she was like, well, okay. And she took her time doing it too, you know, because she had like, she had definitely had like ideas of how she wanted to do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, we just took the time.
Touches like that too.
Yeah.
These people have idea.
Yeah, she definitely.
Compared to some people who don't know anything. Like
and,
me.
And the thing, and well, the thing, like us. And Mike, you know, like this track. Like, when you first listen to it, you know, it's a little bit, like, dissonant and, like, you know, the band's really loud.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, if you give it a half a dozen listens, you start to hear, like, especially, like, in what she's doing, there's hooks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's hooks in, like, what she does. Like, especially after, like, the big, big bridge, like, where it gets really loud and it comes back in. She does some stuff, like, the cadence of her voice, it's so hooky. So there's that one, and then the next one's like the Ballad of
You like this because of the bass.
Well, and also like, what's Alan's last name, Carla?
Wilner.
Alan Wilner. The story of how he did this. I mean, now Alan's like not like a singer, you know. He doesn't like, you know. He's not like a front guy for some band. He's at the studio. He's sitting on the couch. We're listening to the track. There's no vocals on it, and so we're trying to figure out. Who's going to spiel on this? Who's going to do something? So, I can't remember if it was Joel or Matthias, but someone said, Alan, why don't you try it? and like, just go for it. He went out there, and like, what we're going to hear, it's a one-taker. No punches, no revisions. Alan went out there and did it. Like, just like what you're going to hear.
Damn.
Yeah, we were all... pretty much. He said, well, I can do it better. I'm like, no.
You're done. Put a fork in.
Okay. Well, but about the Ballad of John Henry, yeah. As far as like between me and you and the bass, yeah, we were trying to get steam drill sounds on the bass. And I think we did.
You drilled it.
We drilled it.
It's a red apple day, they say. I don't agree. It's a red apple day, they say. I don't agree. In the rest of the valley of the river of the night, I feel obliged to be dark.
a red apple day, they say. I don't agree.
Digital numerical core, as soon as we see. gets nowhere.
Watt from Pedro Show. We just heard a bunch of songs there from the second Book of Knots record, Train Eater, and Tone went and described all that to you. And now I got the Book of Knot percussion man, stick man, Matthias Bossi.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, glad to have you aboard, Matthias.
Thank you, sir.
Now, we're still here in the tiny telephone studio in San Francisco.
Hiding out from the rain.
Yeah, it is raining.
Sure is.
There's a lake outside the hatch. I stepped in it
And Ian told me a good technique: if you get your shoes soaked, stuff them with newspaper, and it draws out the moisture because they're dry now.
Yeah, you should have brought the yak with you, man.
The paddle. I should have brought the boat. I flew in.
Yep.
So it was lame. Right. If I would have drove, the yak would have been here. I could have paddled my way out of that hell. I could have paddled around and searched for the set list, too, because lost that, so we're going to have to recreate that.
Yep.
But that's okay. I want to get into how you got started with music, Matthias. First time I played with you was with Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum.
Yes, in Missouri.
Columbia, Missouri, about 5 years ago.
Yep.
6 years ago. And obviously, you were playing before that.
Absolutely. Yeah,
You started as a young Cape Codder?
I did, yeah. I grew up on the Cape with Joel, the engineer, guitarist, multi-talented man in the other room there.
Fellow Bucanotter.
Exactly. Yeah, I actually started out playing the violin.
Wow.
I did. Age 5.
School?
Yeah. I learned on the Suzuki method and got really good. So good that they put me in the orchestra and gave me the notes. But I couldn't read because I learned with like the apples and oranges technique. There were no notes. I don't even remember what Suzuki technique looked like. But I got good at that. I had a good ear and graduated to the regular orchestra with the other kids. And I couldn't read any of the notes, so I sat there in the back with doing air violin. Never even touched the strings.
Mime.
I didn't have. I
love it.
That's right. That's right. I didn't have a love for the violin. I used to get real nervous when I was a kid and being up there with that instrument.
How'd you get on it?
My parents decided, like, oh, right. I see we have a young Paganini here. We need this boy to be the next soloist. And they actually got me a loaner violin from our dear family friend Bob Wentworth. It was like that special violin that he had in his living room on a little stand on the bookshelf. And
wow.
I got it immediately and I covered it in peanut butter.
Yeah.
Fuck that thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love it now. My wife is a violinist. I mean, it's one of my favorite instruments, but it never connected with me.
So you left it.
I did. Sometime in third grade, my brother's childhood friend, Ned White, gave me an old Ludwig vintage 70s sparkle drum kit.
Wow.
With the yellow sparkles with a mismatched blue sparkle floor tom.
Was it his idea?
It was his mother's idea. He had left, and it was in the basement, and... Oh. She hated the thing. It was all dusty and, you know, rat shit in it. And she just gave it to me. I didn't know what to do with it. It had all these extra drum heads. I didn't even use the bass drum. So what I did is I had the floor tom as the bass drum. I would just whack it with my right hand with a stick and pile all the extra heads on top of the head that was already attached to the drum. So I had this, like, Quaker Oats box cardboard sound. And we played the snare drum. I wasn't very good at the beginning. Actually, that was the start of my first band in third grade. We were called Lover's Luck.
You already had a band.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Me and Jordan Silverstein, my next-door neighbor. I actually sang, and he played the drums.
He was playing your drums.
He was playing my drums.
Now, did this lady have a beef with your parents?
Oh, no, she was a good woman.
Because my parents might have been a reason why she...
My parents were really supportive. I sat up in the basement and they loved it.
You know that thing you buy for Christmas, somebody you hate.
I know.
So the kid does the bam bam and drives him nuts.
My parents loved it.
Yeah, all right.
I think they had withdrawal when I left at 18. You know, there wasn't any more banging. No. I started a band called The Moms. The Moms. That was really fun. You know, kind of a couple of really beautiful horn players. Saxophone, an alto player and a tenor player. And I was in jazz college, I guess you would call it. So I was learning all my legit stuff and checking out.
Are you writing tunes?
Yeah, that's when I started writing tunes. Wow. It's funny, I went to college with little or no harmonic knowledge. Drum music is written across in a line,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
There's no pitches. So I had to start from scratch learning like my keys and my notes and my sharps and flats. And at that point, I really got into it, but I'm loving the piano. And I started to write tunes, but all I could do was write the melody, and I would bring it into my teachers and say, can you harmonize this for me? And I'd say, oh yeah, that sounds good. And then I realized, like, you know, bit by bit, I started studying with this trumpet player named John McNeil from New York. And he taught me my chords and stuff,
right.
And voicings on the piano. And that's when I started writing.
And so is the Moms doing gigs?
The Moms, we were doing some gigs in... In college, it was kind of a short-lived project. I started it towards the end of my college career. with a friend of mine named Jay Flower, who's a wonderful, actually electronic musician. He does a lot of laptop stuff. He's kind of the right-hand man of an amazing composer who's from Boston and now internationally known, named Oswaldo Golihoff.
Oh, wow.
He's been working with him. They just did this new Coppola film. Coppola came out of the woodwork after 10 years after not making a film. And yeah. Jay's been doing a bunch of film stuff. And we always did like really kind of slow grooving atmospheric stuff. I just kick back and lay it down in the pocket, and we'd have these kind of... He wrote very beautiful music, but there were always some weird little like twists and turns and non-predictable harmonic shifts.
So you learn piano, but you're not doing it in a band. Just composing.
He actually wrote most of the music.
Oh.
I didn't start writing on the piano until, I don't know, probably 5 years ago.
Okay.
Once I got out of school, you know, and I
well, the Sleepy Time guys are on the West Coast.
Yeah.
So how you meet them?
Well, that's a long story, my friend.
Okay.
It goes like this. I was playing in a band called Skeleton Key from New York.
Yeah, incredible.
And we shared the same agent as Sleepy Time. We were on the East Coast in New York, and they were obviously out here on the West Coast. 5 years ago, a little more than 5 years ago now, she decided, oh, it'd be a good idea if you guys did a little package tour. Do the circuit, do the whole country. So we came out here, met him at the bottom of the hill on December 12th, 2007, and totally hit it off, man. Just amazing people. Skeleton Key and Sleepy Time got along well. Very different bands, but I think a great double bill.
2007.
No, 2002. That's right.
Seven looks like it, too.
Right,
yeah, but between Moms and Skeleton Key, are you in bands?
Yeah, I joined a band, and I moved to New York after Boston.
Yeah,
I ran there, and I joined a band called Vic Thrill. This fellow named Billy Campion, who was the lead singer of a fantastic sort of Talking Heads-inspired underground East Coast band in the early 90s called the Bogmen. And he had a resurgence in the mid-90s as Vic Thrill.
Okay.
Total freak solo performer. I joined him playing kit behind him, and he would dance around naked in like, you know, cheerleader outfits and just in small
naked in cheerleaders outfits.
Yeah, small Brooklyn clubs.
Yeah.
And so I was playing in his band for a while, Billy, Vic Thrill.
Yeah.
And then I joined Skeleton Key.
Okay.
And we went on the road. It was sort of a Mike Patton had put out.
Sure.
There was Skeleton Key had, you know, in the mid-90s, when they first came out, they had this crazy skyrocket to fame.
Yeah.
Capitol Records.
Yeah.
And they just like got lost in the shuffle there. It was that Jesus Lizard time where all these fantastic bands were being signed and by major labels, and then no one knew what to do with them.
I remember.
So they released one record and it petered out, and then they kind of disappeared. And you know, in that meantime, they toured themselves into the ground. And I joined in the resurgence. There was a record called Obtainium that came out probably 5 or 6 years ago now, and I was out touring that record with them.
When you're touring with
Skeleton
Sleepy
Key.
Time.
Yeah, exactly. Tour. That was the
So you meet those cats and what?
Yeah, and then here's
saw somebody waning and somebody waxing.
Well, we spent Christmas down in LA in 2002. Stayed with
Michael.
With Jello and Buzz.
not the band Christmas. It was around Christmas.
No, it was around Christmas in 2002. Sleepy Time being from the West Coast.
Jello and Buzz from Melvin's.
Yeah. Jello, we stayed at their house, watched The Thing, that Carpenter movie.
Yeah, they did something called Lard or something.
Yeah, I think they did. So we were supposed to meet Sleepy Time on the 27th. A few days after Christmas, we were going to hook up in Austin for a show. And Sleepy Time, I mean, Skeleton Key, you know the deal. You don't pay, you don't play, you don't get paid. So you got to keep going. You got to sleep and feed ourselves. And so we had a few gigs on our own, and we're going to meet up with them in Austin. And sure enough, driving out on I-10 through Joshua Tree, Scirocco Summit, actually, the guitarist falls asleep at the wheel in our old plumbing van, and we roll the fucker at 70 miles an hour on I-10. Go down into the gully between the east and west lanes of the highway. I think I'm dying. There I am. Like, oh my God, really? 23 years old? It's all happening in slow motion. The windshield's blowing out. The rocks are coming in and hit us in the head. And like, bah! We land on the roof. The car's still running. oh my God, I'm alive. Unbuckle my seatbelt. Take off running across the desert. Oh, there's my sleeping bag. Oh, there's my bass drum. Oh, fuck. Look, there's the guitar. And my video camera.
Scattered.
And I thought I was paralyzed. Like, I was tweaked.
Yeah, but you made
it. So sure enough, we all made it. Split our onions, man. You know, I mean, it was like scary, scary, scary shit. And
it's the end of the band.
No, sure not. No, we spent the night on Christmas in the emergency room, and the next day call sleepy time and say, by the way, we're fucked. Our van is crashed. What can happen? So they rolled up in their bus in the desert, picked us up, loaded our gear in, drove out across country. We finished the tour together in the bus. Got really close. That's where I hooked up with Carla. That's where our love affair started.
Yeah.
And later that summer, their drummer left to get his PhD in political science at UC Davis. And they held auditions. I came out.
UC Davis, that's a veterinarian school.
Yeah, well, I guess
maybe
so.
You got a poli sci thing.
Yeah. In the health of kittens. Yeah. You know? So later that summer, I came out and auditioned. And sure enough, here I am in California.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, book or not connect.
Right, exactly. Here, well, I had just finished a tour in 2003 with the Melvins and Tomahawk, Patton's band. Skeleton Key was the opener for this little package deal called The Geek Show. And we came back from that tour in the spring of 2003, and Joel and Tony and I had always been trying to get a recording project going over there at the G, at their little clubhouse.
Where'd you meet Joel?
Joel and I grew up. His wife.
He's a Cotter.
Yeah, he's a Cotter. His wife Rachel I grew up with her. I've known her since elementary school, and her brother Nick was my best friend. So, and her mother is also a colleague of my mother, both being musicians. And Joel showed up on the scene when I was probably 15. So. And he was already in bands touring around, Glazed Baby, and this band from Kansas City called Shiner, which were fantastic. And I always look up to him. I was like, oh, wow, yeah. He's older than me. You know, he's probably 8 years older than me, so I was still a kid. And really
admired. Can we invite your board?
Well, at that point, no, because I was like really obsessed. I was in the jazz land, man, and he was like total punk
rock.
No,
for this not.
Well, no, it was kind of, and I said, Joel, you know, later when I moved to New York, I started, dropping by the studio, and we really started getting to know each other, and playing and stuff, and I said, man, we should make a record at some point. We started hanging out at the studio, our first couple shots fired I don't even want to tell you what the name of the band was going to be. It's embarrassing. Our first
Canats was a good name.
It's a great name. It's a great name. We started getting together in the studio on our first couple things. It's like when we all get together in the studio. You have to fuck around for a day before you get rid of all the shit and then finally get to like the seed. You know, we started playing like these weird fast tunes with odd meters, and it just wasn't happening for us. And then we did this really like slow dooming song, and we were like, oh, this feels real good. And I wrote some lyrics, some sort of nautical inspired lyrics, and then we started sending emails back and forth, and I said, man, let's just make a record of this stuff. We started making all these really slow tunes, overdubs here and there, and somewhere in the middle of that, this fellow Mauro Arambidi, who had a fledgling label in Austin, Texas called Arclight Records, stepped in and said, hey, you know, I like this stuff. Let me put it out. And to this day, it's still in print. It's doing great. You know, the first record, and, you know, we just kept churning them out. We meet very sporadically, probably a couple times a year. We meet for like 4 days and really, you know, bang it out, and nothing is precious. We hold on tightly and let go lightly. You know?
That's great. Yeah. We're going to play some music
here. Please.
Some Matthias Bossi music.
All right.
And we get done with it, you tell us about it, okay?
Beautiful. Thank you.
uncle used them. Christ used them to build the ark with Noah. Stanley screwdrivers, the good old red, white, and blue. Stab yourself. Stab a house. You can build anything with a Stanley screwdriver. With a Stanley screwdriver, you're the boss. You're the president. Things go up easily. Stanley screwdrivers. Fanta makes you invisible. Oh, God, the bubbles. Oh, God, the joy. Take me to the pool. Show me your Fanta. I fantasize about the orange flavor, the grape flavor, the strawberry flavor. Good for the kids. Good for your life. Pop a few in the trunk. Take a picnic. Drive out on the highway. Pop a Fanta. Pop yourself a Fanta. Papa.
I'm the one who wanted it. Why ain't you been the one to give it up? I'm the one who wanted it. Why ain't you been the one to give it up?
All right, we just started off that chunk with a piece of mine called Lost in Wyoming, kind of a melancholic lament, not even a lament, a meditation on the silence of the highways and byways of Western America, a place that we all know very well. Driving late night through the prairie, you're the only one up on the bus, you're behind the wheel, and...
Probably I-80.
Yeah, exactly, I-80.
I-80's got gates.
Yeah, I know. Turn back. Go to Cheyenne. That's right. I always like that one.
Rock Springs.
Yeah. So that's from my as-yet unreleased solo piano record, something I've been doing for a couple years here, and I never quite have enough time to write more music for it. So at some point, I will release that. Little musings. After that... We heard something from my absurdist commercial reel called Stanley Screwdrivers.
You gotta explain to people what is a commercial reel.
Well, I think
you're the first cat on the Watt from Pedro show to have a commercial reel.
All right. Well, these are my dream is to be transported back to 1954. I think the only way that's going to happen is like actually when the apocalypse happens and 100 of us are left in a bunker, I'm going to be the guy who does all the commercials for the radio station in the bunker. I'm obsessed with that, the 1950s a tone of optimism. So yeah. I decided to do a reel of commercials touting various products. I just improvised them in the studio. We did it for the Book of Knots show last summer in New York at the Gramercy Theater. We had this big whole 75-minute loop of me just blabbering on. And it was running the whole time. And then the minute the songs were done, we'd up the faders and hope that we were in a good moment. So Stanley Screwdrivers and Fanta, your favorite soda and your favorite screwdrivers. Mo Stiano has just arrived, friend of ours, going to play some percussion today. Hello, Mo.
Hello. Hey, Mo. Matthias likes to babble. That's one thing he's really great
yes.
professional on.
Well, he's explaining his music. It's more higher elevation than babble.
That's right.
It has a point. It has a purpose.
Yeah. Next we have the French. Which is a piece that I recorded here at Tiny Telephone a few days ago for an upcoming dance piece by the Joe Good Performance Group.
No, but Wonder Boy.
Yeah, it's called Wonder Boy. It's in collaboration with the Joe Good Performance Group and this puppeteer named Basil Twist from New York. Something Carla Kilstead and I did here at Tiny Telephone a couple days ago. This is sort of one of the main themes of the piece, a very kind of whimsical slash melancholic piece that illustrates this puppet's inability to take anything lightly. He's a super sensitive character that is obsessed with beauty and darkness. It's soon to be a wonderful piece. I think it's going up in June at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. First and second weekend in June. That's called the French. But I don't know. But we'll call it Wonder Boy.
Street from SF MoMA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have styrofoam grass in the middle there. There's all these rolling hills. They built a parking garage underneath, and then in order to sculpt the landscape, they made the hills out of styrofoam and then planted grass on top of it. And lastly, we have Puppet Show. You sense a theme here.
Yes,
puppets.
That's the GUI.
We love puppets. That's right. From
this is with the Sleepy
Time. Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum's latest record, Inglorious Times, out on the N Records. It came out last May.
And Joel?
Joel recorded it here, actually. Actually, that track was recorded at Studio G in Brooklyn. But Joel has his hand in producing and recording some of this record. It actually came out of a puppet show that we used to do live on the Sleepy Time tours. Nils, the singer's mom, had this old wicker basket of... these traditional Swedish mythological characters and I would puppets and I would break them out in between and do this puppet show. And then eventually I forgot them and so I would go out and start to do like these commercial reels that I just played, like these absurd monologues in between tunes, and the name Puppet Show just kind of stuck.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's kind of a it's a big kind of Carl Orff, Carmina Burana inspired gothic waltz.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Matthias, thank you so much for coming aboard.
Pleasure, man.
Man, you are a Renaissance man.
Thank you, dude. Thank you. Pleasure talking
pleasure
to you.
Pleasure to serve aboard the Book of Knots.
Oh,
with
man,
you.
It is an honor to have you. This man impersonated Chuck Yeager this morning. I don't know if you can believe it. Tell the world.
Okay. Thanks, brother. January 23rd, actually it's 24th now, we're doing the show over 2 days. 2008, it's Watt from Pedro's show, third hour. And I'm going to play you part two of Jack Flanders in Dreams of India.
It's funny. I travel halfway around the world, and here I am in the middle of India. And I'm still me. And I'm still lost. I could have stayed at home and watched a video. There's someone doing his prayers. That line from the Bhagavad Gita. He who abandons all desires and acts free from longing, without any sense of possessiveness or egotism, he attains to peace. Peace. Desires? No peace. Peace? No desires. Doesn't seem fair. Here I am, just sitting on a bench at a bus stop. But I'm not waiting for a bus. I'm just sitting. It's funny. When you think of all the places in the world that won't allow you to just sit still. Restless minds sure run this world.
Every child comes with the message that God is not yet discouraged of man.
Ah, the words of Rabindranath Tagore. Well, it's getting dark. It's time to head back to the hotel.
I cast my own shadow upon my path, because I have a lamp that has not been lighted.
So true. But tell me, Mr. Tagore, did you ever ask, is this the way back to my hotel? I thought I knew where I was, but I don't. I'm lost.
Silence will carry your voice like the nest that holds the sleeping birds.
It's getting dark. Oh, I can see the lights of the hotel up there. I think I can get there by taking this little street here. Houses, trees. It's very peaceful. Strange, though. It's as though layers are being peeled away. I can see through the walls into the houses. Even the trees are transparent, glowing with a light that is so vibrant, so alive. People are walking toward me. I can hear their footsteps, but they have no bodies. They're just ovals of light floating above the ground. remember this. Oh, it's gone. Damn it. You just can't hold it. I should know that by now.
So, Jack, were you sightseeing?
I guess you could say that, yeah.
And where did you go?
Well, I wandered about. I found a charming street not far from the hotel. And you?
Business.
What is your business, Carmen? Personal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, tomorrow, Bombay?
Yeah. I've reserved rooms at the Taj Mahal.
The Taj Mahal? Really?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea you could stay there.
Not the Taj Mahal. The Taj Mahal Hotel. It's in Bombay.
I knew that.
Well, you should know that. It's a beautiful old Victorian hotel built by the English. It has a view of the harbor and the gateway of India.
You know, I notice there's a lot of English spoken in this country.
That's because English is the official language of India, Jack.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm. Before the Mughals, India was really many different countries, each with its own language.
Oh, like Hindi, Bengali?
Marathi, Punjabi, Gujarati, Tamil, Malayalam, Urdu.
Urdu?
Urdu is just one of the languages you'll hear in Bombay.
Urdu.
Kashmiri, Kannada.
Canada?
Kannada, Uriya, Sindhi,
okay.
Assamese.
Okay, fine.
Telugu.
That's enough.
Dogri, Maithili.
I give up. Good grief. So, the English occupied India for what? A couple hundred years?
Yeah, in 1947, when the English left, the only ones who knew how to run the country were the clerks. And English was the one language spoken by all the clerks across the country.
Uh-oh.
So every state has its own language. In the south, for example, in Madras, they speak Tamil. In the northwest, in Calcutta, they speak Bengali. Yeah. In Goa, they speak Konkani.
Okay, so where are we now?
We're in Bombay, speaking English, Jack.
They certainly use their horns a lot in this country, huh?
It's a wonderful Indian law. If you hit someone without blowing your horn first, it's your fault.
Oh. There are no scooter taxis here.
No, traffic's too fast in Bombay.
Yeah, sure puts New York to shame.
But Bombay's real claim to fame is that it's the film capital of India.
Really?
I think India makes more films than any other country.
Hmm.
But except maybe one, but no, I can't remember which one.
Are the films any good?
I think they're just awful. You know, they're a combination of, cheesy and repressed. You know, we Indians are very prudish.
Prudish? Well, that's hard to believe. I mean, after seeing photos of those temple carvings where, well, they're very imaginative.
Well, they were done a very long time ago, Jack.
Well, what caused the change?
I don't know. It may be because we've been a conquered people for so long. First the Mughals in the late 14th century, and they were in power for 300 years. Then the English for another 200 years.
Hmm. Oh, hey, look at that. They're playing cricket.
I know. It's a national obsession.
Certainly is a weird game.
Ready to receive this delivery from Kapil Dev.
Oh, the driver thinks we want to hear it on the radio.
Yeah, for us it's just like listening to the baseball game.
So, how did the English take over India? I mean, did they just invade?
No, it was through the East India Company. Have you ever heard of the Black Hole of Calcutta?
Of course. I stayed in one of their hotels in Manaus. It's a chain, isn't it?
Oh, Jack, would you like to hear the real story?
I've always been fascinated by black holes.
Well, the Nawab, who had just come into power, felt that the English were just intruding into his affairs. So he rounded up some of them and shut them into a small room. Now, unfortunately, in the heat of the Bengali night, 50 of them died. Now, had it been 50 dead Indians, the incident would have been forgotten. But for the British, it meant Indian treachery, it meant Indian cruelty, and it was just what they needed. So they played it up in the British papers and overthrew the Nawab, and the incident was the perfect excuse to take over the country.
Even back then, they knew how to manipulate the media, didn't they?
Oh, yes.
So that room, That's the Black Hole of Calcutta. Huh.
So, Jeff, what do you think about the Taj Mahal Hotel?
It's magnificent.
Vera, idhar aao.
Yes?
Aapke paas pink pelican beer hai?
Pink pelican? Yes, of course. Pink pelican, great.
Two pink pelican, please.
Immediately, ma'am. This is a wonderful lounge. All this wicker. And you can see the harbor, the Indian Ocean, the gateway of India looming before us. So peaceful. And right around the corner, the beggars are waiting to pounce. You know, I haven't seen any snake charmers yet.
Just wait, Jack. You'll see them. You'll see the lepers, the snake charmers, sadhus on beds of nails. You'll see gurus and yogis. Everything you ever thought was India.
You know, I'm beginning to realize that that is a very small part of this country.
Two pink pelicans.
TK. Well, Jack, bottoms up.
Where'd they learn to brew beer like this?
From the English.
Oh, it's better than English beer. And it's cold. You know, in this light, my God, you're just so gorgeous.
They say the sun has his simple robe of light. The clouds are decked with gorgeousness.
They also say this world is the world of wild storms kept tame with the music of beauty.
I see then you know our poet, Rabindranath Tagore.
Well, not personally.
I see. Well then, Jack, I'll leave you to yourself to wander Bombay.
Well, any suggestions? Where to wander?
You could take a boat to the Elephanta Caves.
Hmm.
Or you could hire a taxi and go to the Ajanta Cave just outside the city.
Well, do you have anything else besides caves, I mean?
I think you'll find them very interesting.
Yeah, well.
The Ajanta Caves have wonderful paintings with the story of Buddha's life.
The Buddha?
Yeah, Buddha, you know, was born in India.
Well, of course.
He preached his first sermon in Banaras.
Buddha's caves. The paintings.
Mm-hmm. So I'll leave you?
Yeah. Have a nice... namaste. Is there something more?
Another saying just came to mind. It may apply to you.
Oh?
My heart has spread its sails to the idle winds for the shadowy island of anywhere. So I'll see you then this evening for dinner.
Of course. With Kamala. Why, the Elephanta Caves, the Ajanta Caves, the Black Hole of Calcutta. A lot of dark holes seem to come up in our conversations.
Many, many caves.
How many?
They say 35 caves.
Are they all filled with stalactites?
Who they fill?
You know, the... never mind.
The Ajanta Caves are not natural, no?
No?
No, they're carved by hand.
By hand?
Into the rock.
Hand-carved caves?
Some caves very, very big. Many rooms. Some caves very, very small.
This guy sounds like he's doing Peter Sellers.
Some have steps. Many steps.
Carved into the rock?
Yes. Some have pillars. Many, many pillars. Some have paintings.
Many, many paintings.
Yes. How do you know?
Oh, never mind.
Live from Pedro Show, that was part two, Jack Flanners and Dreams of India. Jack on another adventure. And somebody who actually knows about Jack and his adventures has witnessed a few of them. I got with me now Mr. Joel Hamilton, who is one of the Book of Knot Meisters.
That is me.
Seeing that this is kind of a Book of Knot edition of the Watt from Pedro Show, it's my extreme privilege to welcome him aboard here.
Well, Joel. Thank you.
And
he's going to do some doubles and triples.
All right.
All right. Now, yeah, you could hear the Book of Nod in motion there.
They're actually they're recording without me. Usually I'm the guy that's sitting in front of the console
the
whole time,
so
everybody's gonna come in every 30 seconds now while we're.
But I grabbed him away, right? I grabbed Joel away because I wanted him on the show and explain to you how he got to be a Book of Nodder. How did you get started with music?
My dad actually played drums in a really bad band, some kind of like bar band sounding thing, you know.
Was this Cape Cod?
It was on Cape Cod, yeah. Okay. But the band
couple
practiced.
Bars there, right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them, that's all anybody does. Are you kidding me? On the Cape when they're not out fishing, you know, they come in off the fishing boats, and what they do all winter is drink.
And the cranberry juice and the what cup?
Oh, that too. Yeah, exactly.
They got the Cape name,
Cod,
right?
Man. Yeah. But so all the instruments were in our basement. The band practiced in our basement. So I had the benefit of going downstairs and, like, you know, messing with the Fender Twin that I wasn't supposed to touch when the guys weren't around. And I got the benefit of a drum set and a bass amp and all this stuff was around.
How old were you?
Wow, man. I mean, from the time that I can't remember till, you know, till I was probably 10 years old or 11 years old. But I started hitting those drums as soon as my foot could reach the kick drum pedal from the stool, you know. And then I picked up the guitar and I was in my socks. And I remember, I'll never forget this, I was probably 6 years old. My socks were wet and I'm standing on a cement floor and I touched that Fender Twin. And the thing brought me to my knees and I was like, I'm going to master the fucking power that just brought me to my knees this morning. Someday I'm going to hold that juice in my hand and aim it at other people.
Like a fire.
That thing just took me out.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I kind of played everything. I didn't know what I wanted to play. But the big deal was when a friend of theirs brought over a 4-track. And I got into that thing at about 10 years old.
Record?
Yeah, man. And I was like, as soon as I recorded myself going, hey... And then I learned how to put it on the next track and go, what? It was on, man. I was like, wow, this is some shit here.
It must have been an early one.
It was. It was like a quarter-inch teak reel-to-reel thing. And that's another thing I'll never forget, man. That changed the whole course of my life right there. I don't even know the guy's name that left the 4-track there. I don't know, but it changed everything.
It was a very critical donate.
It was a critical donation. But so anyway, like, I got kicked off into the whole, like, music thing, but coupled with the recording thing, it was not just about playing.
Yeah.
I always wanted to play something into a microphone. I was more interested in that than even the whole touring thing. But I did all the kind of, like, punk band, like, touring in vans that smell like feet that we all know.
Did you do any school music?
I did. I played upright bass in school.
Oh.
And I played the snare drum, you know, sort of like drums in the symphony type of thing, which is just like some crappy, like, flamming once in a while.
Event-driven.
Yeah, it was event-driven drumming.
Not time-driven.
But
Rook told me, yes, he says, yeah, I can play drums. I was in the school, but I can't hold time.
Yeah, you don't have to. You don't have to. You got somebody, like, wiggling a stick at you anyway to keep time. But so basically it was like coming up through the kind of anti-music scene, you know? It was like coming up through everything. I mean, I'm sure at some point, like, Three-Way Tie for Last was on the cassette deck in the fucking van, you know, or whatever. But just like that stuff was all what we cared about. You know, it wasn't like, I mean, I liked Van Halen as much as the next guy, but that was never what I wanted to be. You know, at any point, I felt like there was something that I needed to say that was unique. Like, the idea was to be myself the entire time, not to model myself after any one particular. Yeah. You know, I didn't look at you know, some guitar hero guy, like I say, Eddie Van Halen or whoever it was, even Jimi Hendrix. I saw that the reason they were Jimi Hendrix and Van Halen were because they came up with their own shit and did it in front of a lot of people and kept stuck with it. So to then model yourself after someone original, to me, seemed wrong, even at 10 years old, you know?
Right.
Even beyond Jive, though, just sort of like that it wouldn't work. If I thought it'd work, I might have done it.
Because Jive can kind of work, right? It's a half-ass.
Yeah, we've seen Jive work. A lot of Jive.
Did you ever put a studio around this 4-track?
I did. I wound up, well, if you count the basement,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
hung
yeah.
up some blankets and recorded my friends and shit like that. And
did you give it a name?
No, I never had a name, man. It was just like, I'll bring my four track. Because it wasn't like, I mean, it didn't feel like a studio ever. Like the way people seem to want to have this quasi-professional environment, because you can buy all the shit now and make your bedroom into something that has 48 tracks. I mean, I didn't even dare to call it a studio. I had a cassette four-track machine that, like, track four may or may not work that day, and I'm recording all the punk bands around, like, you know, from Providence to Boston to Cape Cod, and I'm driving around this shitty old car. And it's like, you know,
so
that's not
like
a studio. Yeah, man. Okay. You're just going to, or like their house, you know, whatever it is. And I'm bringing four mics for four dudes. You know what I'm saying? This mic's for the drums, man. So but yeah, man, it was just through all of that kind of thing that I wound up meeting good people too, like all around the country, and I realized that what I liked the most about music was the recording of it. I kind of more than making it night after night, because I started to feel like a human jukebox. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just playing the piano. Same thing. Yeah, player piano concept.
Feed me the scroll.
Yeah, and it was like I wanted to be at the moment of inspiration. That was the part that I liked, was like right at that moment where you see somebody go, aha.
Yeah.
And something great comes out. That's the stuff that still gives me the chills, the way, like, Free Your Mind and Your Ass Will Follow when I was 12, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, and there's, being on tour, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you've done it more than me, but, I mean, I did it for 15 years, which was enough to get a handle on what it's about in the punk scene, you know? In a van that smells like buffalo wings and feet and an ashtray. It's like, you know, that it's too fucking genre specific too.
Yeah.
You like all kinds of music, you're not going to hear any of it except the type of shit you're playing on that tour, really.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm playing in some heavy rock band, there's not going to be some badass band that sounds like Parliament playing right after us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Felt like real homogenized, like I was getting trapped in this one little subsection. Yeah. Yeah, inbred little scenes everywhere. You'd say the same fucking 12 dudes that always have the same joke for you. And I started to get sort of annoyed at that, and I wanted to get back in the studio, and we started the Book of Knots as a studio-only project that was just going to, like, not pay attention to any kind of genre constrictions at all.
And the connect was Studio G, because Tony told me a little bit you were hanging around.
Yeah, I was hanging around. I was partners in a studio down the street, and we sort of would bump into each other, and Tony said, hey, why don't you come... why don't you come help me out with this one mix or whatever? You know, he knew I was like an engineer, the like hotshot kid in the neighborhood at the time or whatever.
Now, how'd you end up in New York? Quit touring and I'm going to live in New York.
I was in Kansas City and I had a recording studio out there called Trainwreck.
Yeah.
And that flooded in those big Midwest floods. Like, I mean, water up to my neck. I watched it bubble up past my console. I mean, that was like my life. You know what I mean? It was like everything that I cared about was in that room at that time. And, you know, I watched just like sewage, raw fucking sewage and like water, like city water, bubble up past the meter bridge and my tape machine over the console. It was nasty, man.
Oh, man.
Like Mississippi water, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Big muddy.
Muck, man. And so that...
Turd, piss.
Yeah. Like all kinds of shit. Because, I mean, we were in the building and it felt like we were in a boat that was going down. Because the water was going up, and all of a sudden the mail slot, there's like a fucking girder of water, the shape of a mail slot, blasting in through it. Like high PSI style, you know what I mean? Like, so loud. And all of a sudden we feel the building go, this big movement, you know? And we run upstairs, and we're looking out the window that looks on the side that the water was coming from. And I don't know, when there's a flood, I don't know if there's like dudes that have a kit that they like throw in logs and an upside down car. Like, there's no trees anywhere near there. But for some reason, every flood I've ever seen looks the same. It's like muddy water with some weird logs kind of messing. Yeah, some furniture and shit. So anyway, the flood kit was coming at us, and it's like there were cars bouncing off the side of our building and dumpsters and like big pieces of stuff. And we saw like stop signs all of a sudden disappear under the water, and it was because we found out later that it's because there were parking blocks like skidding down the street, like skimming down the sidewalks at, you know, 20 knots. Like crazy. It was a crazy place.
So Studio World in Kansas City was over for you.
Done. Totally done. And it was such a sign of almost biblical proportions for me. I was like, I got to get the fuck out of the Midwest. I grew up on the ocean, man. Like the water came and got me. When I tried to leave the water came and got me.
Coming home.
Said, hey. So I just decided to get the hell out of the Midwest, basically.
And come you found back a up. Gig in Brooklyn.
My gal was moving to New York City. She's a textile designer. My now wife, she's a textile designer in New York. So it was like there was a logical place for us to be because both of us kind of needed a town like that to be a textile designer and a recording engineer, producer, person. You better be somewhere like L.A. or New York, or right. You know, just wasn't going to happen in West Yarmouth, Cape Cod.
So you're down the street from Tony, you bump into him, and you end up working at Studio G.
Yeah, man, like working together. He kind of asked me to come in and help out. I guess the short version is that Studio G wound up getting ripped off.
Yeah,
and tell me that story. And so I kind of decided to get out of a partnership that was crumbling anyway, and bring in my gear and help out because Tony and I had sort of become friends at that point. I wanted to come help him out, so. That kicked it off, and we've just like gone crazy since then. Studio wise, it's been good.
Yeah, now we're gonna play some music here when you were in your band mode.
Yeah, man.
And well, let's just play it now. We'll explain it.
All right.
After.
Okay.
You turn yourself invisible.
So we just heard 4730 Birthday Cake by Iron Right Mangle, which was a band with some childhood friends of mine, Rich Toomer and David Silver. They played in a bunch of other bands at this point that are not really worth mentioning. that was kind of our spastic demo from 93 or 94, recorded in a basement somewhere in Rhode Island. Right before that, we heard Let Me Take You to Chinatown by Glazed Baby. That was a band that I toured in for ages, and we were kind of notorious for stealing gas so that the rest of we could buy drugs with the rest of the money that we made at that point in our darker days in life. So we would just leave the gas pump off the hook, we would call it, so that it wouldn't beep inside of the truck stop. So they'd look up, we'd just leave with the gas pump on the ground every single time and not pay. It worked pretty good. So anybody out there listening, that's how you steal gas at a big gas station. Just leave, don't put it back on the pump, because then it beeps and the attendant looks up. All right, so right before that, oh, we're going like newest to oldest here. It's this is the latest one. It's called Hero Snake by Players Club, which was me and guys from a band called Hell No and Unsane. We had that band for a couple of years, actually. It was Dave from Unsane. Jimmy Paradise was the drummer. He was in Hell No and Citizens Arrest and Rorschach and a bunch of bands like that. Seminal kind of ABC No Rio New York punk bands. Players Club was a fun kind of scallywag bunch of people. That was going on. Dave's on the first Book of Knots record, actually. He plays on one of the songs. So that was going on when we formed Book of Knots.
Oh, man. And right now we're in the midst of the third Book of Knots, and the concept?
Space. Air and space, actually. See, what's fun about all three of these, like, that people... This is the special, like, you know, we're going to wrap it up for the first time here on your show. It's that the third record will be the final record, and it's by land, by sea, and by air. But we included space in it because the whole thing, the whole concept is just about frontiers. It's about the idea of what's out there being much more exciting or frightening or whatever, what have you. It's more than what people actually found when they got there.
Yeah.
Like sort of heading out from the East Coast, or the pilgrims coming across and they hit dirt. And then started the westward expansion. You know, it was like all these frontiers, and we're running out of frontiers on Earth.
What do they call that? Manorat next to me.
What's that? What the hell is that? Is that a word?
Or manifest
two
destiny.
Words. Or manifest destiny.
So was it Manorat next to me? That was the biggest reason for westward expansion.
Right. So it's somebody had a mastectomy, and you can't get you have to leave the earth after having a mastectomy at this point, because you're not going to find anywhere else to have a mastectomy. How did this happen?
Maybe I got an ear infection.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, it is. It's
frontiers pushing.
Yep. Just always pushing out past what's comfortable. It's why the music is uneasy. I mean, it sort of all ties into that. It so perfectly ties into it that it's almost embarrassing. It sounds like some sort of committee decided on this idea for some sort of merchandising for a mall. You know, but it wasn't that deliberate.
Target market.
Yeah, we knew our target demographic, see? But really, though, this third record... That with air and space, I feel pretty strongly that the concept of something out there, it's tough to have that on Earth anymore. Like, yeah. Where can't we go? Like, where can't you just go on Google Maps and see exactly Google Earth? You can see exactly what fucking Easter Island looks like sitting in your dorm room.
Yeah.
You know, or you can see exactly what downtown Tokyo. You can go down to the street level and look around. So it's like, where do the fucking unicorns live these days?
Yeah.
You know, where are the orcs?
Right.
You know? I mean, besides in Danish speed metal, like, where do the orcs live? You know? So,
space.
Yeah. They, to me, I mean, what's out there?
Yeah.
You could say that there's some sort of beastie living 10 million miles away from us right now. Nobody can tell you you're wrong at this point. If you say there's some sort of beastie somewhere in downtown Tokyo,
they'll get it on the,
yeah, you can figure out pretty quickly that that may not be true.
So it's an explorer.
It is. It's exploration.
It's an endeavor. Mm-hmm. Further, beyonder, more vigor. Well, man, thank you so much for having me aboard.
Yeah, man. We're so glad you're here.
Much respect. And thanks for sharing your music journey with us here.
Thanks for sharing with
the
people.
I know you got to get back to your Knots.
I do.
Because the ship is adrift.
Yeah, man. Things are drifting right now. I got to go grab the helm.
Thanks, Joe.
Nice one, man. Good talking to you, brother.
Planted one day by a glance. pushed me there. You pushed me there. Had to ask every question. You brought me here. Did I ever say from time take all the time?
Was Daisy Bell by Tin Hat and Crisis by 2 Foot Yard from the upcoming record Borrowed Arms.
You're listening to Carla here, who's the fourth member of the Book of Not core crew.
Hi.
And those are two of songs that she's got on music. Yeah, she's got singing.
I'll try
so
not
she's
to call too much.
But I wanted to get her perspective in here because she is part of the core of the Book of Not Collective, which reigns in other freaky personalities. Like, I've been allowed to come on board a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I just dropped some bass. And Brother Tony right now is putting his bass on the bass.
Yeah, that all being laid upon the tracks by Matthias and Mostiano, Mo playing a car buffer.
Right. That's ingenious way the way things are put together.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be coughing.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why I did that. That will be coming down. I'm all nervous. But what I want right here is to hip you guys to Carla's music, which brought her into a situation where she could become a part of the core of Book of Not. And so how'd you get started with music?
Oh,
maybe a little one?
A wee one. Indeed, a wee one. My mother's father was a Hungarian fellow, an engineer and a sculptor, and a violinist by hobby. And his sister was a violinist by profession, a Hungarian violinist named Erzbieta or Elsie Laszlo. And she, very long family story, but I'll drop in to the point where I enter the picture, which will cut off a lot of years of it. she had some kind of inclination that maybe I had a musical bone somewhere in my body and gave me a teeny little violin. And I picked it up, and I...
While you were teeny.
I was four. And I was about five when I actually started, taking lessons. So I was about, I was five. She had me sing something and said, I think... And she said to my parents, I think that she maybe has something for
me. But
music.
There was a tradition in the family.
Yeah, I mean, to my knowledge, she was the only professional musician in the family. But... lots of amateur, musicians by hobby. My grandparents always had chamber music parties and just hanging out with their friends, reading string quartets. That was their version of a party. And so from the time I was about eight, I was playing Mozart string quartets and Haydn string quartets with them. And they're old friends, which are some of my kind of favorite memories. And I think it's to this day why I like small groups, I never would want to be a soloist. Like my idea of music was hanging out in the living room playing with a bunch of old folks,
But you're in the pad playing. Did you bring this to school or get some from school?
Yeah, she gave me a violin, and I think my parents didn't really think it was they didn't have an agenda. They weren't like concert parents thinking, oh, this will be the next Heifetz, you know. But
saddle her up.
Exactly. But pretty quickly, like, I really dug it. I really got into it. And I was really serious. I was always like the girl with the furrowed brow and like the knit brow, looking at things and trying. Like, I was not.
Brack.
Yeah, I was not so happy-go-lucky as a child. Okay. I mean, I was, but I really liked being alone and kind of focusing in on things. So for me, it was a pretty instant fit. So it kind of went further than they expected it to, but once it did, like, I did that whole thing of, like, going driving forever and ever, every week, driving an hour and a half each way, every week, sometimes twice a week for lessons, and because I outgrew the teachers in my hometown, and then had to drive an hour and a half away to Philly, and then had to, you know, outgrew that teacher and had to drive an hour and a half to Baltimore twice a week. And so it became this, like, it kind of snuck up and became this really integral part of my life.
Amazing, like classical at this
point. Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing gigs with orchestras?
No, I mean, well, yeah, to some degree, actually.
Or little quartets?
I did a couple, like, I've kind of totally forgotten about this stuff now, but when I was about 11, I played with the Hershey Symphony, like, as soloist, and started doing, kind of did some orchestra gigs, went to Europe and played with like the Netherlands Radio Chamber Orchestra with this other girl, it was a Korean girl who came and lived with us for 3 years to study with my teacher then, and she was super, super serious classical prodigy girl. And so most kids in my high school are, you know, while they were playing sports, and it's like that age-old tale, like it's such a caricature of that life that it's almost embarrassing. But while everyone else was playing sports, I was practicing. Yeah. Like, it's kind of true, except sometimes I was watching TV and pretending to practice. But yeah, I went to summer camps for music and really did that whole thing. And then at a certain point, towards the end of high school, I started to get that feeling of like, I don't think this is all there is. And
to life.
Yeah, to music, even.
Or to music. Oh,
really, okay. To music. Like, it was such an important part of who I was and what I did. Right. And that.
But no bands.
No bands, not till college.
Okay.
Not till college. String quartets were my bands. Like, orchestra was my bands.
Yeah.
And it was, there's such a...
And so no composition, probably.
Actually, that's not true. I studied with this great, weird old lady
right.
I was little. When I was about 8 to 10 or something, I took composition lessons with this lady in Lancaster. I can't remember her name now. It's killing me. I can't remember it, but I'll find out tonight. I'll have to ask my mom if she remembers. But this lady who was a composition teacher, and she had like a big blonde bouffant, and she had a studio in Lancaster with two grand pianos in it facing off, like facing each other. And she always wore like white go-go boots and this big white bouffant, and had a chandelier, like some big candelabra chandelier sitting on each piano. She was such a character. And so I actually studied composition with her, and then wrote my first piece about my guinea pig, Jester. And
well, that's great, because a lot of classical training, that's the one weakness, is writing their own songs.
Yeah. Well,
where
you get
so... those three chords.
I'm telling you, there's some like liberation and freedom in that way of approaching music, being like, here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third chord. If you need it, you might not even need it. Now go write 12 billion songs, and they're all going to be, like, there's something to that that is really liberating, and, like, there's, the classical model really has you revering these composers that were, quote, masters, and you're never going to be as good as them, and you're never going to sound as good as the recordings, and you're never going to, you know, they were brilliant, and they were doing this by the, you know, so there's this hero worship that I think could be really debilitating for classical musicians sometimes. So I kind of escaped that mentality by the grace of some really influential people that I met early on that kind of started hipping me to some other concepts and other ideas. And so I feel pretty lucky, because I feel like I always kind of got the best of that world and then ran away with it. Okay, I got some tools here.
There's got to be stuff out, especially on the technical stuff.
Yeah.
God, they must.
Yeah.
Getting this thing with the instrument, you probably never gain from just feeling around the dark and trying to service a tune. But there's something about serving a tune.
Yeah.
And so college comes and now you start bands.
Yeah.
Or become parts of bands.
Yeah, there was a couple bands that I was involved in college. I also started working with some people in the jazz department, which is kind of a fledgling new department. I went to Oberlin Conservatory.
Yeah.
They had just started the jazz department. There was this great teacher named Wendell Logan that helped us create a new a kind of combined. It was half were a few classical students and mostly jazz students, but the whole idea was to explore kind of alternate ways of creating structure. So we did a bunch of Ornette Coleman tunes. We did a bunch of like kind of graphic scores. We did a lot of like kind of taking melodies and stretching them out in all kinds of ways.
Improvising.
Yeah, but in a way that wasn't totally by the jazz book. Like it wasn't like here's the changes. Now you know learn all your modes and chords and play on it. It was like more kind of just exploring different ideas of form and really cool. And he was great. He was such a really very really great teacher and kind of let us explore all we wanted. And so that was pretty great for me. And I also had one of my best friends was a choreographer, and I started like writing scores for her and doing sound collages for her pieces and doing all kinds of stuff with her that was like off the books and just kind of have our own events off campus that we couldn't get credit for. And so,
but Oberlin, a pretty artistic school.
Yeah,
I played there. It's not like Ohio State or.
Yeah, it definitely is, and also the classical department really has. I mean, I'm sure it's changed a lot since I've been there. It was a long time ago, but there's definitely the more conservative, like more standard traditional classical minded thing there. And then there's a few teachers that are like always jabbing the rest of them in the ribs, you know. This great teacher named Randy Coleman who was so funny. He'd be like, listen, half of what you think you know about music is only because you've been socialized to think that. If you were from Micronesia and you listened to a Beethoven symphony, it wouldn't have the same emotional like pull in the same ways because you've learned what a minor chord means in your culture. You've learned that minor means sad. You've learned that major. Like, people used to get so angry at him. he's still kind of an ass kicker. He's really great.
That's good stuff because people can't look beyond the context.
Yeah.
And especially something like music, which is universal.
Yeah.
To go beyond context, it's still imprisoned by it because we're humans.
Yeah.
Even though the act of sound itself is bigger than humans,
mm-hmm.
It's universal. Huh?
Yeah.
Before us, after us,
yeah.
During us.
Yeah, well, and
suffers
that whole,
during us.
That much perspective really has the ability to shake the foundation out from under a place like a music conservatory,
right.
You know, which is based on certain
fiefdoms of power. Okay. So, what about like what we just heard, the 2-foot yard, the tin hat, these kind of things?
So, these are two groups that I'm in. Tin Hat has been a group that I've started with a couple friends of mine a really long time ago when I first moved out here, like in 94 or 95. And it's kind of
I love
it
when the 90s is way back.
Yeah.
For someone like me, that's healthy.
Yeah. It was back enough. It wasn't.
It is.
Yeah.
So it's a band you started way out of the college experience.
Well, just out of the college experience, actually. So, right, just when I moved out here, which is the beginning of 94. And it's kind of an old-fashioned group. You know, it's all instrumental. It's all acoustic instruments. Most of them are from, like, the mid-1800s with a little teeny pump organ and beautiful old Martin guitar, acoustic Martin guitar, and my violin. And, you know, it's all kind of older, old-fashioned. There's no there's not any electronic anything to be had in this band, and it's kind of more melody based and kind of chamber music based than anything else that I do. And this song, do you know Bruno Schultz, the Polish, have you ever seen The Street of Crocodiles?
No.
The brothers Quay did this great, this animating, they're an animation duo, these brothers in England. And they did a
Stop
really
action.
Great, yeah, exactly. Really beautiful, elaborate, kind of dark and playful all at once. They did a kind of interpretation of this book by Bruno Schultz called The Street of Crocodiles. But Bruno Schultz was this beautiful Polish writer and artist, and was killed in World War II. But before that, he had written a couple books and done. He was an art teacher, and there's a book of his called Sanatorium Under the Sign of the Hourglass that is such a brilliant, beautiful book. It's really, he's one of the first surrealists, really. Just beautiful, beautiful writing. So we made this whole record loosely based on his writings. So in a kind of abstract, loose kind of way. And there's he mentions the a couple lyrics for the song Daisy Bell, and I just haven't quite put together the melody and the lyrics. I'm very naive. I'm just going to say that right now. I'm incredibly ill-informed and very naive. So I was reading this book, and we were trying to find different scenes or different words or, you know, phrases that would inspire like different songs from on our parts. And so I took this little piece of the book where he talks about the lyrics of Daisy Bell, and I researched the song and found all the lyrics, and still I didn't realize what song it actually was. And of course, it's that the Daisy, Daisy, give me your to-do. That is the age. Everyone knows this song.
Right.
And so, but I hadn't heard the melody because it was a book. I was only reading the lyrics.
Sure,
I just
sure.
didn't put it together. So I sat for a couple hours and was like, I'm gonna write the song that this goes to. And I totally rewrote the melody and the chords, and it became this really dark, really, like, oh, like no longer the happy-go-lucky song about the, you know, the entry of the bicycle into popular culture and the courtship of a young. It's now like, wow, Daisy better get a restraining order. pretty bad. So that, then we kind of did a little chamber orchestration of that tune. So that was the first track off the Tin Hat record.
And then
the 2 Foot Yard record, which comes out like next month, I think March 4th, is called Borrowed Arms, and the track is called Wow, the lights just went out. That's
yeah,
really
they
nice.
Blew a circuit. We got that. It so well.
I want you in my bunker. So Crisis is a song that the other two people in the group are Marika Hughes and Shazad Ismaili. And this is a song that we wrote together. We were really, often we kind of, we will each write something separate and bring it into the group, and then we'll kind of work it up as a group, and this was one of the times when we actually wrote it like from the beginning to the end. We wrote it all together.
And how'd you get this band together?
This band,
it's more recent.
This started,
right?
Yeah, it's more recent. Probably
it's
like
not
five
way
years
back
ago.
In the 90s.
No, it's more like way back in the aughts.
Yeah, is that what you call these?
The aughts. I think we're in the aughts.
Okay, yeah. I don't know what to call these things. Aughts. Okay, so it was way back.
Yeah, and it started as a solo thing. It started because everything.
Yours?
Yeah, it started because everything I do is a collaboration.
Right.
Everything like Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, Hat, Book of Nonsense.
I've seen this. People think of Violet as something you just bring on board later, huh?
Well, no, it's more just because I...
Or your persona?
It's more about my persona than it is about the violin, because...
But I've seen the other violin players, like, we're not going to put the thing around.
Yeah.
So a couple of...
Like icing.
Petra,
the melodic,
you know?
Icing, yeah.
She's always added on as, like, some garnish.
Yeah, just a little something to make it sweet.
Yeah.
So this was... 2 Foot Yard started out as, like, my experiment in not in finding out what part of all my collaborations actually is me. Like, what do I sound like on my own? Like, I know working with Nils and Dan and the rest of Sleepy Time, and working with Mark Orton and Ben Goldberg and those guys in Tin Hat, and like, it's so fun because they push me in directions that I wouldn't find on my own, and they like kind of stretch your capacity for expression to places you wouldn't if it was more like just writing in your journal. You kind of have certain patterns and certain things you do, and like, so I've always loved doing collaborations, but there was a point at which
I was... How did you meet Sleepy Times?
When I first moved out here, do you remember the Mud Women?
Yeah.
Lisa Faye Beatty, Mud
Women. Yeah.
Like, she's actually still our downstairs housemate, Mud Women, yeah.
It was like WIMMI.
Exactly. So when I first moved out here, I got a bartending job at the Covered Wagon, and on down on Folsom and 9th, Folsom and 11th, something
like that. By Slim's.
It's like a couple blocks down from Slim's. And I was just 21, and I got a bartending job, and there was this girl there, Lisa Faye, who was running sound there, and she was a sound engineer, and you know, ran all the shows, and I met her and became really fast friends with her, and still she's one of my closest friends to this day. And we did a lot of playing together, and she said, "Hey, you gotta sit in with my group, the Mud Women. We got a couple gigs coming up. You should come play." So I went and played with them for a couple shows, and one of them was a show at the Kennel Club, I think it was then.
Yeah.
Now it's the Independent. And it changed names a bunch of times.
BIS Club, I played there when it was that, and it was called Justice League.
Yeah,
it was
the dance. It might have been that. Yeah, down to Visadero, exactly.
And you opened up, across the street was Brother-in-Law's, number two, Great Ribs, and even the Church of St. John Coltrane.
It was right on that block, or down the block, something like that.
Yeah, a couple blocks down.
Yeah. So we did a show there, and they were sharing the bill with Idiot Flesh. And Idiot Flesh... I was like fresh out of college. I had run screaming from classical music. I mean, I grew up, like, the music that moved me most in that world was like Bartok String Quartets, which, if you haven't checked them out, some of the greatest music on the planet.
Pierre Boulez to conduct the Magical Mandarin.
Oh, yeah.
Mandarin?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's so...
Also, that dynamic, I'm not used to it. Mm. And here's all these 60 great musicians.
Yeah.
But then when they let go and let him get hold of it, you could tell they were fighting him at first, and then he got it in the whole thing.
And
for me to be part of watching that
and
feeling, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
As much as almost a little Richard Gigg or something, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
These technical people bringing together some really, really, really raw emotion.
We were just listening in the car a couple of days ago, Matthias and I were listening to these recordings of the Arditti String Quartet playing Ligeti, the first Ligeti String Quartet. And it is as raw and as visceral and totally kick-ass as any punk rock tune you've ever heard. I mean, it's this kind of idea that classical music is more, like, inherently more, like,
stayed
refined.
Stuffy.
It's really, that's just a matter of taste. Like, yeah, there's composers that do that, and then there's... Like, and there's players that do that, and then there's players and composers that are looking for that same raw thing that anyone else is looking, you know, that anyone
just
did,
like there's people doing the rock and roll. That's pretty boring.
Yeah, exactly.
Very staid.
Yeah,
it's all the spirit of it, and this amazed me. And the Bartok, just to begin with, those compositions, I would talk to some guy who knows about classical music. He said he borrowed a lot. He'd go and listen to folk songs.
He was one of the first. I mean, there was other people clearly who did that, but he traveled all throughout Transylvania and through Hungary and that part of the world and collected folk songs and cataloged them. Has a huge archive of folk songs from all these different towns, and at that time communication wasn't what it is today, so things were really specialized from one town to the next. So it wasn't like everyone knew the same song, the same Britney Spears song from the radio. Like, it's just... He kind of got all the details of the different cultures. And then he'd take those rhythms and those melodies and work them into into his music. And
beautiful
it's
stuff.
It's really amazing.
That was an
beautiful thing. And the interaction between a conductor and a band, I'm not used to it. The closest thing is like playing in Iggy's band. And so was Perry Farrell, in the Porno for Pyros. Both those gentlemen.
They know what they want.
But it's weird because if the others, at the same moment, they've got this incredible abandon. You think that they're totally oblivious to everything because of the crazy thing, but then they're hearing every note.
Yeah,
and they know where.
Yeah.
And you look back at me.
Yeah, that's the thing when you like people that can walk that line between like absolutely letting loose and still somehow in some way like holding it all in one container and like
it's incredible duality, a dangling duality.
Carla Bozlich has that too.
She
rides that same like the world constantly falling apart around her in just the perfect way so that everything's like in flux and moving and ready to like.
So you know Carla.
She's
from
Peter.
She's from my town. I noticed that she's like 16.
Wow.
And she's had it since she was young.
Yeah.
This way of singing and a persona, no matter what music she's doing, the Carla comes out. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So you meet the Sleepy Times from doing these Mud Women gigs.
Yeah, we did this one gig and I was...
And it is kind of a collect. They bring a lot of cats on, right?
But for sure, back in those days especially, they really had the
kind of circus a little bit.
Yeah, but also like if you really listen to the music, like a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of the compositions are really really full of detail and like but they're still really like intense emotionally and they're still really like they're really focused and clear and like bizarre and like full of great sounds and I didn't know that existed outside of Bartok quartets, you know what I mean? So I saw them and I was like, what? Okay, these are people I need to find, I need to like to know these guys. And at the same time, like I had been warming up backstage and didn't really know anyone, whatever, and I was playing, I was just kind of fooling around. And when Nils tells a story, he has the opposite side of it from what I have. He's like, we were like in the other dressing room, and we hear this like weird violin stuff, like a violin played like we've never heard it played, like kind of some kind of Bartok-ish improvised thing. We're like, who is that? And then I played with the Mud Women, so that was kind of the first time we like eyed each other sideways, like, wait a minute, who's that? that's kindred spirit. So I mean, it took years before we actually were then. Well, then I joined Charming Hostess as a singer, and those guys were in Charming Hostess.
Right.
And then finally, years later, when Idiot Flesh called it quits, we started Sleepy Time out of the ashes of what had been Idiot Flesh. So that's the short story.
Yeah. And then through that, the Book of Knots, Matthias, Joel, Tony.
Yeah, they'd been going at it already. I think Matthias wasn't long out of school and had moved to New York, and they had had this idea of just doing this studio based no pressure kind of thing, which is what I love about this band so much. So like it has no ambition in that, like, you know, like it's not driven by ambition at all. It's got a certain kind of drive, but it's not based in ambition, which I really love. Sleepy Time did a tour with Skeleton Key, which was Matthias's band back then. And I'm sure he told you the story about the rolling of the van and the van becoming the shape of a trapezoid all together wrong. And
they all lived.
Everyone
got in the school bus.
Got in the bus, yeah. So that was kind of the beginning of that. I started to go to visit Matthias on the East Coast now and again. A couple times he was working on stuff with Tony and Joel, and I'd stop in the studio. And it'd be like, you know, as they are now still, anyone who walks in is fair game. You just put set headphones on them and tell them to go. What do you want me to do? I don't care. Go. I'll sing something here. soon, what did I know? I was actually in the band. So, and I think also it's like they cover a lot of ground between the three of them.
Yeah.
But the part that they don't cover is the more like melodic stuff that is what I bring to the table, like the violin and the kind of theremin vocals and the kind of smooth over the top of all their demolition and destruction. There's some kind of like teeny silver lining at the edge. It's kind of so. I think that's in some ways it was a good fit because there was a thing that I brought that they didn't have already.
Yeah, and some estrogen too.
Yeah, exactly. And that never hurts, except it hurts me like once a month. It never hurts them though, unless I get really crabby.
All right, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you
so much. Oh. Truly.
I'm at the Oakland airport now, waiting for a plane to take me to Long Beach Airport and then on to Pedro. Just as wet down there as it is up here, but I still think I'll get home today. I do want to give a big thank you to the Book of Knots folks, Tony, Joel, Carla, Matthias. They're most righteous and generous for having me aboard there for 2 days in the studio. Let me sail along on their third endeavor there. And I hope I was able to help them with some bass, some spiel, some piano plucking even. And it was great to have them do spiel on my radio show too. This has been the January 23rd, 2008 edition of the Watt from Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.